Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, we'll hear from a mom who was once prominent in the movement against vaccines, but now she's a vaccine advocate, and she has tips on how to talk with anti-vaxxers about their fears. The election is getting closer. We'll hear how election officials are working against misinformation and those who call into question the validity of voting results. The financial aid process has been a disaster, with many students struggling to complete the FAFSA application. We hear about the impact it's had on high school counselors. An effort to provide research opportunities to community college students could help them complete their education. And this is the first year the state has recognized girls' flag football as an official sport. We'll head out to a game and see how players and fans are reacting. Those stories and more on Statewide. Stay with us. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Former President Donald Trump has historically had a rocky relationship with the city of Chicago, but he got a warmer reception this week when he spoke downtown at the Economic Club of Chicago, and Dan Milopoulos covered the speech. He talked with Melba Laura about it.
First of all, what stood out to you about this event?
Well, as you mentioned, it was a warm reception. He was applauded by some people in the audience when he took the stage. They stood up and cheered him, and he got some laugh lines in there throughout, and was applauded again at the end with a couple of people yelling, you know, USA. There were about 500 people at this event, almost all of them white, for what that's worth, and he was interviewed by the top editor of Bloomberg News. But, you know, Trump, he likes to, quote, weave among different topics. So at one point, foreign policy came up, and he dodged a question about a recent report from Bob Woodward, who's put out there that Trump has continued talking with the Russian leader, Vladimir Putin, on multiple occasions since he left the White House.
Can you say yes or no whether you have talked to Vladimir Putin since you stopped being president?
Well, I don't comment on that, but I will tell you that if I did, it's a smart thing. If I'm friendly with people, if I have a relationship with people, that's a good thing, not a bad thing, in terms of a country.
But really, this was one of those things where you wonder why Trump was here. We're close to the election day, and this is not considered one of these swing states that's crucial to the election. He's lost Illinois twice, lost really badly in Chicago. And so everyone thinks it's solidly Democratic turf in next month's election.
That's a great question. Also, Trump's Chicago appearances have been few and far between since he entered the political stage almost a decade ago. He's been met with protest, and he's criticized the city multiple times. Did you hear any of that?
No, I was expecting it, but he didn't really talk about Chicago at all. For once, it's almost like the event could have been anywhere in the country. You know, in 2016, the first time he ran, he couldn't stop talking about Chicago crime. And he skipped out on a 2016 rally at University of Illinois Chicago altogether because more of the people that wanted to boo him than his supporters showed up there. But today, no mentions of Chicago, although he did refer three times to a hometown favorite, the former Democratic president, Barack Obama. And each of those three times, Trump very pointedly used Obama's middle name, Barack Hussein Obama.
Well, if the president didn't talk about Chicago, he touched a little bit on foreign policy. What else did he talk about?
Yeah, this was supposed to be mostly about business and economics. But as the event went on, Trump started to meander and weave again, and kind of regardless of whatever questions were put to him, he would hit his campaign talking points. He defended January 6th as being mostly about peace and love. Said it's been misrepresented in the media. He knocked the media, of course, insulted Kamala Harris's intelligence, saying that she would fail a cognitive test, in his opinion, and he repeatedly stoked fears of what he calls illegal migrants. And at one point, he pointed to someone in the audience and said, "You're a beautiful woman. And if you come across a migrant, one of these what he called murderous migrants, says she wouldn't hesitate to kill you."
And Dan, before I let you go, Trump seemed to get a warm reception from the Economic Club of Chicago crowd. What did you hear from the attendees if you got to talk to some of them?
Yeah, it didn't really have the feel of a Trump rally like we see in other states, but there were people with MAGA hats or wearing red with Trump brooches. And, you know, they said they enjoyed themselves. We should point out the Economic Club says they also have invited Harris, but we don't know if she'll be here before Election Day.
That's WBEZ's Dan Mihalopoulos covering an appearance at the Economic Club of Chicago by former President Donald Trump. Thanks, Dan.
My pleasure, Melba.
Well, ahead of the election next month, Illinois election officials say misinformation poses the biggest threat to undermining the integrity of the vote. The last two presidential elections were marked by Russian interference and false claims of voter fraud. As part of the Democracy Solutions Project, Tessa Weinberg in Chicago has more on how election officials are trying to restore voters' trust.
At the Sulzer Regional Library on a recent Wednesday night, an informational video and hands-on demonstration try to ease voters' concerns with a blunt message.
The bottom line? You can trust the voting machines.
But less than a dozen attendees huddled in a semicircle around one of those very voting machines still had lots of questions about what would come next on Election Day. They wondered,
is there any way, especially in this election, a judge could sabotage somebody's vote? How are the judges vetted? How protected are the servers in our governments like Russia and China getting access to our voting?
In the run-up to November 4th, polls show election security is top of voters' minds. The Cook County Clerk's Office is doubling up security officers for election sites. Election officials have Narcan on hand in their mailrooms in case they receive fentanyl-laced suspicious packages. And state lawmakers recently passed new safeguards to protect election judges from retribution. They can now leave their names off of ID badges. Chicago Board of Elections spokesman Max Bever says they need to be ready for anything.
We do have to prepare for the worst, no matter what.
This November, Illinois voters are also going to recommend whether more could be done. An advisory question on everyone's ballot asks if candidates should face civil penalties for interfering with an election worker's duties. State Representative Jay Hoffman led the effort to get the question on the ballot. He says those penalties could come from making threats or acts of violence.
It's one thing to allege fraud. It's another thing to threaten an election worker. First of all, it's against every democratic principle we have ever, as a country, stood for. But secondly, it's going to have a chilling effect.
When it comes to protecting the physical ballot, voting equipment also has rigorous safeguards. Cook County now has GPS devices on the metal cabinets that contain voting machines sent to each precinct. Machines are never connected to the internet. Officials keep a strict chain of custody over who's interacted with the machine. Drop boxes are under video surveillance. Here's Chicago Elections spokesman Bever.
Illinois is still an all-paper ballot state. So no matter which way you vote, either on a touchscreen or by paper ballot, there's always going to be a paper trail. And that's important because paper ballots can be reviewed for audits and recounts as necessary.
The Illinois State Board of Elections spokesman Matt Dietrich says widespread misinformation pushed by bad actors, both domestic and abroad, threatens these security efforts.
They are trying to get into the minds of voters, and they're trying to pit voters against each other.
Back at the voting demonstration at Sulzer Library, Mary Dudek was hoping to learn strategies to help the average person sift through the noise. She says it can all be overwhelming.
Listen, I'm a healthcare provider. I went through COVID.
She saw firsthand how quickly misinformation about COVID vaccines spread.
I was shocked by how impacted we all were from that misinformation. And now I'm seeing that same kind of process unfolding again. So it's very worrisome.
Meanwhile, Barb Lymans is with the League of Women Voters of Illinois and co-chairs a task force about mis- and disinformation. She says if people have questions about election security, there's no better way to get answers than signing up to work as an election judge.
You become the perfect purveyor of accurate information and support of our election systems.
She says at the end of the day, she has a new motto around this topic that comes from an old saying in journalism. If your mother says she loves you, check it out. Tessa Weinberg, WBEZ News.
Police regulators in Illinois are a step closer to being able to strip an officer of their ability to work in law enforcement without having been convicted of a crime. But some say the proposed rules from the Illinois Law Enforcement Training and Standards Board don't go far enough. Kimberly Schofield spoke with Sam Stecklow. He's a reporter and editor for the nonprofit newsroom Invisible Institute about the development.
Sam, I understand the new proposed rules would lower the bar for stripping police officers of their badges in Illinois. Tell us more about that.
So up until now, officers have only been able to lose their certifications from the state, which is what allows them to be hired as a police officer, if they had been convicted of a felony or certain misdemeanors. And that's been the system that's been in place since the 1990s. And so this is the first time in Illinois history that an officer will be able to lose their certification without first having been convicted of a felony or a small handful of misdemeanors.
Sam, what do the proposed rules say, and why is this a significant development?
The rules lay out a process for how hearings of decertification cases that are being heard by the Certification Review Panel of the Illinois Law Enforcement Training and Standards Board, which is a new body that is being created just to hear these decertification cases. It will lay out exactly all of the rules for complaints, administrative law judges, and some information about appeals. And this is a significant development because hundreds of cases have been piling up at the Illinois Law Enforcement Training and Standards Board after these new provisions were passed as part of the 2021 Safety Act, but they haven't been able to take any action on any of these cases because they haven't had this process in place. Experts say that this is a step in the right direction because there have been no rules in place up until now to conduct these hearings and to prevent officers, so-called wandering officers, who leave one department after committing misconduct and then go to a new department, prevent them from being able to do so. And the only way to prevent that is by stripping their state certification. But experts say that there aren't enough set rules about how regulators are going through all of these hundreds of cases that are being received by a LETSBE and being disposed of without any set public rules in place. The hearings that are going to be held are of cases that have already been at least preliminarily investigated by a LETSBE and have decided to go forward with a hearing. But that means that there are hundreds of other cases that will not go forward to a hearing. And I spoke to Amy Thompson, who is an expert with Impact for Equity, about this missing process.
What's the process to determine whether that investigation was adequate? And then how will they decide whether to launch a formal complaint based on those investigations? You know, what factors are considered? You know, none of that information is fleshed out in these rules. And so I think beyond the little that's in the Illinois Police Training Act, the public is kind of left in the dark to understand this large section of consideration of decertification, what's going to happen there.
Sam, what's next for these proposed rules, and what will you be paying attention to going forward?
So these rules have been in the works since long before the killing of Sonya Massey, who was an unarmed Black woman, by Sangamon County Sheriff's Deputy Sean Grayson, who had a history of misconduct with several departments before he was hired in Sangamon County. But that incident has put a lot of pressure on regulators and state lawmakers to make sure that this process is in place. So experts I've spoken to say that there are still many things that they would like to see reflected in proposed rules, including guarantees of public access to these hearings and case files. That has not been addressed, as well as other public databases that are supposed to be available. And so both the implementation of these hearings and when they start having hearings to decertify officers and other rules that should be coming down the pike are things that we'll be paying attention to. We did submit several questions to LETSBE officials, but did not receive any response.
That's Sam Sticklow, a reporter and editor for the nonprofit newsroom Invisible Institute, and he spoke with Kimberly Schofield. Well, the Nobel Prize in Economics has been awarded to James Robinson of the University of Chicago and two economists from MIT, Darren Acemoglu and Simon Johnson. They're honored for demonstrating the importance of societal institutions for a country's prosperity. They found societies with poor rule of law and exploitative institutions don't generate sustainable growth. Professor Robinson talked with Mary Dixon about it.
What is it like to win a Nobel Prize?
It's a little surreal, to be honest with you. Yes.
Did you get a call?
I did, but my telephone was switched off, actually. It was my wife woke me up because her friends texted her.
So from the ridiculous to the sublime, you're being recognized with the two other professors from MIT. on societies that fail to recognize the rule of law, institutions that fail to recognize the rule of law, they see lower growth. Can you explain a little more about what that means?
Yeah, I mean, we you know, the big picture, we've been studying for about 30 years the differences between poor and rich countries, trying to understand, you know, why the world is as it is today, you know, divided into countries, some of which are prosperous and others are poor, and what created those divisions historically and what sustains those divisions today. And what we've found is that it's really related, as you say, to their institutions. And particularly, you know, we emphasize the role of inclusion, both in economics and in the political sphere, having institutions, having rules that create very broad-based incentives and opportunities for people in society. That's what creates prosperity and economic growth.
Some of this research had to do with a study of colonialism. Is that correct?
Absolutely. I mean, if you want to understand why the world looks the way it does today, colonialism played a huge role, you know, in impoverishing many countries in the world, in Latin America, in Africa, but also enriching others. So you know, I agree with you. It's a very appropriate day to be celebrating and thinking about the history of colonialism and how that created extractive institutions in many parts of the world, including the United States.
I was going to say, I understand that you've done field work all over sub-Saharan Africa and Latin America, and that's where a lot of your interest lies. But are there some lessons from this research for the U.S. in 2024, especially as we head into a very consequential election?
Oh, completely. I mean, what our work shows is that inclusive institutions are always challenged. There's always people who have an incentive to make society more extractive, even if that makes the society less prosperous. And I think it's obvious in this country at the moment, there are massive challenges to inclusive institutions. We have somebody running for the White House who denied that he lost the last presidential election. That undermines democracy, which is a key part of inclusive political institutions.
Mary Dixon talking with the Nobel Prize winner James Robinson, a University of Chicago professor in the Harris School of Public Policy and the Department of Political Science. There is more ahead on Statewide. We'll talk vaccines coming up next. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Just a few years ago, Heather Simpson refused to get any vaccines for her child. Now she's a pro-vaccine advocate. She tours the country to explain her transformation and how she talks to others about the vaccine hesitancy and fears she once had. Simpson is a single mom from West Texas. She was the keynote speaker this year at the Illinois Department of Public Health's Infectious Disease Conference. She talked with reporter Eric Dito and says she changed her mind about vaccines during a time when health misinformation was running rampant, the early stages of the COVID pandemic.
You know, I really did think that vaccines were the enemy, that they would cause autism, allergies, cancer, everything bad ever. And then COVID hit. You know, I had all these followers, all these anti-vax followers that supported my thoughts on vaccines, and I really thought I was in the right. Like, I would post all my anti-vax thoughts thinking if I could save one child from getting vaccinated, I would save a life, and that would be all worth it. But when COVID hit and my anti-vax followers just waged a war on masks, I started thinking, like, that's kind of weird that you're acting like martyrs. You could just wear a mask and save a whole life. It kind of gave me this weird feeling of entitlement. I kind of got the ick from the whole thing. And I kind of pushed away from them, and I started reading science and listening to doctors and talking to them about my questions about polysorbate 80 and aluminum, and they broke them down into piece by piece arguments that completely shattered my anti-vax beliefs, and I had no leg to stand on anymore after that.
Can you kind of run through your early conversations with medical professionals when you first brought up your fears and anxieties? How did they address that?
I had watched a 9-hour docuseries that promised to be, you know, middle ground, and it was anything but, and that's kind of how I became an anti-vaxxer, you know. It said if you want to vaccinate your kid and be a monster and let them die, then do that. But if you love your child and you want to keep them away from all harm forever, then don't vaccinate your kid. That's kind of how I became an anti-vaxxer after watching those 9 hours. But I would go to like my OBGYN and tell him what I saw in the docuseries, and he would just shut it down immediately and say, you're not one of those crazy anti-vaxxers, are you? I would just turn beet red and cry in my car. I went to my pediatrician when my daughter was born, and I tried to talk about the docuseries, what I learned in it, and I wanted her to convince me otherwise, but she just crossed her arms. I literally remember her crossing her arms and saying, I won't talk about that. They just didn't want to talk about it. And I could have been convinced earlier on. This didn't have to happen.
So what would your advice be for those medical professionals? How should they approach somebody who comes to them with anxieties or fears similar to the ones that you had?
My advice would be just realize that they want to keep their kid alive. And they are really scared, because being a parent is really, really scary. Or if they're not a parent and they're just concerned about vaccines for themselves, they don't want to die either. And this really usually has a lot to do with anxiety, and they want you to convince them otherwise. They want to trust you. Get ahead of it. Learn what they're going to ask and know how to break down that science before they ask it. Don't shut them down. Don't say they're crazy. If you don't know the answer, say, that's a really good question. I can see why that would be concerning. Let me find out and I'll get back to you.
What kind of specific language and tactics do communities like an anti-vaccine use to get people to kind of buy in and stay a part of that community?
We believe you. We won't gaslight you. We know that what happened to your kid is true. What you believe happened to your kid is the truth. We believe that vaccines cause this. We stand behind you. Basically, we're here for you. The doctors are the enemy. We'll support you in this. They use all the right words that I wish the medical community would use more of.
So what led you to originally post your thoughts on Facebook for the first time?
I had been watching these mostly women talk about their anti-vax beliefs on Facebook and just thinking, that's so bold and brave, and I really wish I could do that. And I was so lonely out in West Texas as a mom of a very young child whose husband worked all the time, didn't have close friends or family, and I needed a community. And I wanted a community, and I thought, you know, this is so embarrassing. I don't really want people to know I'm an anti-vaxxer, but what if I just tried and I was welcome into that community? And I certainly was, and it blew up bigger than I ever really dreamed, but I did get the community that I wanted from that post.
I really liked one of your quotes from your presentation. You said, people are not monsters, people are just people. Can you kind of go a little deeper into that?
We like to look at the issue as the person themselves, that we're fighting the people. We're fighting an anti-vaxxer like as a whole person, like they are the bad guy, when really it's anxiety we're fighting, it's misinformation we're fighting, it's people with money that run ads that we're fighting. We're not fighting the freaked out mom, you know. Our fight isn't against people, it's against ideas and bigger things outside of that. So we're fighting the lies and the misinformation and the people with the money, and not just the people that want to keep their kids safe. The pro-vaccine medical science world, they're very nice online, and a lot of times it's because they have to be because of their jobs and things like that. But I think we don't have to be mean, but we can be bold. You know that 9-hour docuseries the anti-vaxxers did? Having a 9-hour docuseries about the terrifying truth of polio and measles and things like that, like fighting fire with fire doesn't have to be mean. It can just be like, hey, this is actually really terrifying and you need to sit down. Like that, like this is the facts. And I just see so many like pretty pictures that are like, do it for the community. And that's not effective for the younger generation. They don't care. They want to be kept alive. They want their kids to be kept alive. And yeah, we got to fight fire with fire. And that doesn't make you mean. That just makes you strong.
How would you approach a conversation now with somebody who is an anti-vaxxer? What would you say to them to kind of begin to change their minds and have them start to see things the way that you did?
I think I would initially ask them what their biggest fear is. Like, what is the worst case scenario in your mind if you vaccinate your child? What, like, literally the worst case? They're probably going to say death. Why do you think that? Well, because I heard this story. What I like to tell people is I was supposed to get my flu shot one day, but I had a reaction to an antibiotic that morning and started throwing up blood. So I had to cancel my flu shot. Had I gotten my flu shot that morning, I would have attributed the throwing up blood to the flu shot and posted it online. Probably a few hundred or a few thousand people would now think the flu shot causes throwing up blood. So really breaking it down to, like, what story did you read that made you think that? Let's walk backwards from your biggest fear and how unlikely that is. You know what I mean? But meet them where they're at. Be like, that's scary. Like, that would be scary to think that your child could die. That's a legitimate fear, and that must be really scary to live like that. And I'm so sorry that you have that fear. That sucks. I'm so sorry. Hey, yeah, you're not a monster. I see that you love your kid.
Absolutely. Can you kind of walk through the idea of taking it slowly? Singular vaccines over the combination vaccine, that just being able to take it slowly, step by step. What are kind of the benefits that you see in that?
I know that there is a CDC schedule. I think the push to make parents stick to that schedule, anxious parents, is doing more harm than good. And having a fully vaccinated 5-year-old, even if they did it one at a time, once a month, versus a fully unvaccinated 5-year-old because you kicked them out of your clinic because they didn't stick to the fast schedule, is really unfortunate. You know, I think it's worth it to have the slowly vaccinated child. I don't know the logistics of what that would look like, having the not fully vaccinated kids sitting in one part of the waiting room versus newborn. I don't know the logistics. I just know that I'd rather have a fully vaccinated, yet slowly vaccinated 5-year-old than not at all.
So what inspires you to share your story? What brings you to stand up on a stage and in a room full of infectious disease specialists and talk to them about this?
My daughter wouldn't be here right now if I hadn't fought for her and with the doctors that gaslit me and just completely blew me off. She wouldn't be here, you know? And so I am so passionate about patient-doctor communication and doctors and nurses and people seeing parents as human beings that want to keep their kids alive and a path forward, you know? Whether that's singular vaccines or slower schedules or anything, like, there's going to have to be compromise. Like, we can argue all day long on Facebook and Twitter, and that's fun and all, but at some point, if we want to get the rates up, there's got to be a way forward, and not everybody's going to be happy, but there's going to be compromise, and there are ways to do it.
That's vaccine advocate Heather Simpson, and she spoke with reporter Eric Dito. Simpson was the keynote speaker at the Illinois Department of Public Health's Infectious Disease Conference this year. Many Americans turned to food pantries for the first time during the pandemic. Experts say that hasn't changed. In fact, Feeding Illinois Executive Director Steve Erickson says numbers have risen even higher.
Many of them are still using the food pantries, and that's a good thing that they know where we're at if they need us. But a lot of those folks have not been able to get to return to work.
Erickson stresses that most people don't use a food pantry year-round, but only in months or seasons that are especially difficult. He says food banks have tried to meet people where they are through programs like mobile food distribution. Feeding Illinois oversees 8 food banks that serve pantries in all 102 counties across the state. State lawmakers are returning to Springfield next month for what is expected to be a short legislative session, and top of mind for some Democrats is gun control. Mawa Iqbal has more.
A group of lawmakers want additional gun regulations. They're proposing to increase the age requiring safe gun storage in homes from 13 to 18 years old. And they also want to shorten the time period to report a gun lost or stolen to authorities from 3 days to 2 days. Here's Senator Ram Vilavalam.
We need to ensure that all of our gun owners are responsible and they know what they need to do to keep everybody safe, including our youth.
The group also wants to keep firearms away from those accused of domestic violence. I'm Mawa Iqbal.
When someone wants to add chicks to their backyard farm or populate a larger operation, they often order from hatcheries. For the past 100 years, those hatcheries have used the U.S. Postal Service to ship live baby birds around the country. Increasingly, customers and suppliers say slow deliveries are causing birds to arrive dead. The Midwest Newsroom's Kayvon Mansouri investigates.
It's an early morning in July at the St. Charles County Fair in Missouri. No rides are running, and frozen lemonade stands aren't open yet. But one corner of the fairground is very active. Children and teenagers are preparing their animals for the livestock show. Evie Golson's pride and joy is a white, broad-breasted turkey.
She's not too big. She's like just the right age, so she's able to still like walk around well and everything, and I can still pick her up. So it's perfect.
Showing animals in the 4-H competition at the county fair is a tradition for 18-year-old Evie and her family. But the path to this year's competition was a bit morbid.
Like, you have to see which ones are, like, stiff and which ones are still, like, floppy, sort of.
Evie's talking about the dead birds that arrived at the Golson's home in the mail last March. The Golson's ordered 10 baby turkeys, or poults, from an Ohio hatchery. As Evie's mother, Amy Golson, tracked the shipment online, it quickly became clear something had gone wrong. She told us about it on the phone before we met at the fair.
So I was going to be able to watch these babies digitally. And they went to the Cleveland distribution warehouse something, and they stayed there. They just stayed there.
Golson says she knew what to expect after the box labeled live bird showed up on her doorstep 3 days late.
Unfortunately, when I got home, I mean, we knew what the situation was. A silent box is a dead box.
This was the second time the Golsons got a shipment of birds through the Postal Service, with most or all the birds inside dead. The turkey Evie is showing at the fair is part of a replacement batch sent by the hatchery. There are rules in place to make sure birds shipped by the U.S. Postal Service arrive alive. For one, shippers have to use Priority Mail Express or Priority Mail Services, which meet specific timing standards. In August 2020, more than 4,800 chicks died in a single Postal Service shipment to a Maine customer. The Midwest Newsroom interviewed hatcheries, breeders, and backyard farmers. Their stories all point to Postal Service delays and other mishaps causing birds to die in transit. Kelly Warren owns Cocktown Funky Orpingtons in North Carolina, where she breeds Orpington chickens, which are popular as showbirds. Warren estimates she's lost a third of the birds she shipped this year, sometimes leaving her to issue refunds.
The one box last week arrived 3 days late. The whole box was dead. All I could do was get my shipping costs back. The rest of it was out of pocket loss.
In a statement, the U.S. Postal Service said it has procedures for the safe shipment of live animals, and when properly packaged and labeled, live parcels get special handling. The Postal Service said it doesn't track the total number of animals that die while in transit, so it's hard to know how widespread the problem is. An interview request was declined. Postal Service delays have become more persistent in the years following the pandemic. In 2021, Postmaster General Louis DeJoy announced a 10-year plan to end billions of dollars a year in losses. Delivery slowdowns are central to the plan. The latest cost savings plan announced in August seeks to overhaul Postal Service logistics, a move DeJoy said could increase slowdowns in mail deliveries, especially in rural areas where deliveries could take an additional 12 to 24 hours.
It's a huge management problem.
That's Congressman Sam Graves of Missouri. He says complaints about mail delays are a top concern for his constituents in the northern third of the state, which is largely rural.
The other members of Congress all over the country are getting the same sort of complaints. So it is something that the government should do and should do well. And right now, it's not being done well at all.
Graves and two other lawmakers recently introduced the Pony Up Act. It would offer some consumer protections for mail delays. As for the practice of shipping baby birds, United Poultry Concerns and many other groups have called for the end of the long-standing tradition. For the Golsons, the replacement shipment of 10 baby turkeys included a blue ribbon winner. Amy Golson says the family's days of ordering birds through the mail may be coming to an end.
This is my daughter's last year showing in 4-H. We will definitely cut back when we don't have kids in 4-H.
For now, the Golson's younger child doesn't plan to show, but Amy Golson says she's grateful the replacement shipment made it in time for Evie this year. For the Midwest Newsroom, I'm Kayvon Mansouri.
Still ahead, we look at what's been a difficult year for college admissions. That's next on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Now we look at college admissions, a monumental breakdown in the financial aid process ground down students, parents, and even the most dedicated high school counselors. Lisa Curry and Phillips shadowed one of them as he faced a year from hell.
You can tell LaVon Robinson has added some special touches to his windowless office at Downers Grove South High School to make it more homey for students. There's a little love seat across from his desk, a side table with a mini Zen garden. This morning in October of 2023, a student sits cross-legged on the love seat contemplating her core values.
Okay. What three do you have?
Financial stability, success, and peace.
LaVon thinks the discussion could spur an idea for the student's college essay.
How do you define success?
Money, being able to provide for everything I want and like my family. Because like my mom was a single mother and just like watching her provide for me and my brother like alone. She did a great job, but like I just know I want to be like wealthy and stuff.
LaVon talks about values a lot with students. This is his eighth year as a counselor at Downers Grove South, a public high school in Chicago's southwest suburbs. It serves kids from across the economic spectrum.
It's a good way to like really get to know people and help them like know themselves and figure out what's important to them.
Yeah, I feel like I didn't do something like this until I was like 2 years ago.
Yeah.
If I could go back and do high school all over again, I would want to have LaVon or someone like him as my counselor. Before getting into applications or essays, he asks students about their latest track meet or their plans for winter break or the prom. LaVon says his high school counselor didn't get to know him like that.
I was like a very like average student. I got fine grades, like I was an athlete. Didn't quite know what I wanted to do. I ended up being recruited by Illinois Wesleyan to go there to swim. I felt like there I really kind of found my passions and kind of figured out who I wanted to be.
Now he lives to help other students find that same opportunity. It's not an easy task. LaVon has 140 students on his caseload. Applying to college involves a million and one steps. And there's this thing that seems to weigh on his mind every day. The students who most need his help are the least likely to seek it out.
We have plenty of marginalized students here whose parents didn't go to college, and like they come from low-income status and they have to take care of siblings where they need someone to like just follow them step by step and guide them. It's a lot to get students to feel comfortable to ask questions and like their wealthy classmates like don't need to ask questions about.
Doing this with only 8 hours in a school day and two young children at home, it's a lot. And unfortunately, helping these students is about to get a whole lot harder.
So now my mom's like stressing with the FAFSA stuff. She actually...
Not long before winter break, a senior comes to see LaVon because the FAFSA, the free application for federal student aid, is late. Families like hers, with few economic resources, rely on it to get help paying for college.
She never got anything back.
Let's try to log in and see. It generally takes 3 days.
Federal officials were supposed to make the FAFSA easier to use. But when it opens months later than usual, it's riddled with bugs. They go unfixed for months and make the form and financial aid even harder to understand and access for the students who most need it. 3 weeks before graduation, a senior comes into his office. She's wearing a shirt that reads, "Art is the lie," to help unsee the truth. The teen is trying to figure out how much she has to pay to go to Illinois State, where she might study art. All LaVon can do is guess.
I'm thinking that this $8,000 will be like the most it can be, because here the federal government said that this is what your mom can pay for college, and since that's a negative number, in theory, they shouldn't be charging you a lot more money than that.
For now, that's all the info the student has to go on to make a decision about how she'll spend thousands of dollars in the next 4 years of her life. It's extra uncertainty and confusion heaped on top of an already complicated and confusing process, Levon says.
A lot of my low-income students aren't even there, just like, in some ways, barely bought into going to college. And when students see, like, well, this FAFSA thing still can't be figured out, and, like, just further goes to the distrust of the whole process, which makes it hard because we know there's a lot of value in a college education and a college degree.
After graduation has passed and the summer, I hear Levon has left Downers Grove South for another job. I wonder if, despite his best efforts, he did get burned out. We hop on Zoom to catch up.
I wasn't unhappy at South. It was just kind of like small things. I'm like, oh, it'd be nice to take the train. It'd be nice to have a smaller caseload. Like, the extra money would be nice.
He says he's not doing college planning anymore, just social-emotional counseling.
I can just kind of unwind on the train and, like, leave my computer at the office and not worry about, like, as much of, like, what kind of panic college-related email am I going to get.
I ask if the FAFSA broke him.
I think a big takeaway from last year is that I think no matter how things shape, the college process will always favor, like, the wealthy and the kids who come from, like, college-educated backgrounds for a variety of reasons. And I think that a lot of work needs to be done to support, like, students who come from, like, marginalized backgrounds.
Levon plans to continue to do some of that work by volunteering for a nonprofit that helps low-income students get to and through college.
Lisa Curry and Phillip with that report. Undergraduate students who participate in research are more likely to stay in school and get their degree faster, but community college students don't have as many research opportunities as their peers at four-year schools, Peter Medlin reports.
Jasmine Garcia Malagon is in her second year at Waubonsie Community College, training to become a nurse practitioner.
English is not my first language, so I see how my family struggled speaking English in the medical environment. So I want to help the Hispanic people to be more confident in the appointments and all that stuff.
Like many who attend community colleges, she's also a first-generation college student, and she had no idea research experiences would even be an option. And she certainly didn't think, in her first year, she'd be working on cancer research published in a peer-reviewed journal. For those asking, the title is Predicting Neoantigens for Cancer Using Next-Generation IEDB and CEDAR Tools, and it just published this fall.
I'm first-generation college, so I need to explain to my family that I'm working, but this work is not for my class. It's like extra project. I'm like, no, this is not homework, but it's important. I need to do this.
Garcia Malagon learned about the project from one of her teachers, Waubonsie biology professor Dr. Sheila Vimu. She sees it as an extracurricular built into her courses. It's also a mentored relationship where she helps students realize they don't just study science, they can do science. That, as she puts it, the information they read in their textbooks isn't just passed down by gods.
So for them to have a glimpse that what you see in there is not just written in stone. It is an iterative process that was done by individuals just like them.
Studies show that students who participate in research are twice as likely to graduate in 4 years and 10 times as likely to graduate within 6 years. And low-income, students of color, and first-generation students benefit particularly well. Dr. Vimu's Waubonsie students just won third place at a STEM poster competition for their recently published work. Peace Kujiwan just transferred to Northern Illinois University after finishing at Waubonsie, and she worked on the project analyzing protein sequences.
I believe the research was one thing that opened a big door for me.
She says it helped her get scholarships and prepared her for the NIU nursing program she's in now. Matthew Cattell was another student researcher. He just transferred to the University of Illinois Chicago to finish his degree in biochemistry, and he, like Jasmine and Peace, had no idea this would even be an option.
Especially at community college, it's one of those things that's not really talked about, and it's a bit more difficult to find those resources.
Community college students in general don't have nearly as much access to undergraduate research experiences compared to their peers at four-year colleges and universities. Jim Hewlett is a community college professor and executive director of the Community College Undergraduate Research Initiative. He helps community colleges launch research programs, and when the initiative started more than a decade ago, they only worked with six schools. But now they have well over 120 in their network.
We have seen our membership of community college faculty members increase over the last 5 years.
Lindsay Curry is with the Council on Undergraduate Research. Curry helps instructors, including Dr. Vimu, embed research into their curriculum and secure grants. That way, community college students who often work and support their families while attending school can have more resources to do their research. But Hewlett says there's not a lot of good data on exactly how many community college students do research. For example, a national survey about student engagement asked students at four-year institutions if they've worked on a research project, but...
That same question on the community college survey asked, did you take a remedial math course? In my brain, the people who designed that survey came into that with this assumption that community colleges don't do undergraduate research.
But they do. And these teachers want to make it easier for community college students to find these opportunities. Hewlett says most community colleges who offer research bake it into their classes. It's how you make sure students don't need to look for it. The experiences are just waiting for them. And he says it's not just a fun and interactive way to learn. It's the most effective way. I'm Peter Medlin.
Girls flag football is on the rise in Illinois. This year, over 150 teams have been competing for the sport's first-ever state championship. Anna Savchinka brings us the story from Taft High School Stadium on Chicago's northwest side.
My name's Jermaine Padilla. I'm a PE teacher here at Taft.
Padilla's dreamed of becoming a coach since he was 17, but he never dreamed of coaching girls flag football, which only became an official high school sport in Illinois 3 years ago. Padilla still remembers how they barely had any players on their team back then.
Our first day of trials, we had six girls. You know, this year we had just shy of 60 girls trying out.
And this year, his team is ranked second in the state and competing in the playoffs of Illinois' very first state championship in girls flag football. Now, his new dream is for his girls to win the regional championship on their home turf. On this Friday night, the stadium lights are blazing, the marching band is warming up, and the girls are taking off their earrings and applying war paint. Coach Padilla pulls them into a huddle before they face the Loyola Academy Ramblers.
Do not flinch tonight. You make a mistake, you get right back at it the next play. You understand me? I'm not expecting they win, I'm expecting dominance tonight. This is our house, let's go put on a show tonight. Let's go. Hands up on three, Taft. Ready? One, two, three.
Yeah!
I watch the game from the Taft sidelines. The ref blows the first whistle and the game has started. The Loyola Ramblers come out swinging. And Loyola scores the first touchdown of the night. The Taft stands are quiet. But the Ramblers don't convert for an extra point. Soon, the ball's back with the Taft Eagles. They move steadily down the field, with quarterback Maylene Nunez making pass after pass. That's a touchdown for the Eagles. They throw the ball into the end zone for an extra point, giving them a 7-6 lead. With the coaching staff now breathing a sigh of relief, I approach Cassandra Rothbard on the sidelines, who coaches Taft's junior varsity team. I ask, what does she think about these girls taking over what was once a boys' sport?
I grew up just watching the Chicago Bears with my dad, and there really weren't women in football, but I just always loved football. I've always been an athlete, so when I found out we were getting like a girls' flag football team, I thought that was the coolest thing ever. Like, I wish we had this 20 years ago so I could have played.
She tells me the growth of the sport in Illinois is part of a national movement.
A lot of colleges are starting to have teams, and you know, girls are starting to get scholarships for this sport, and it's really coming to grow to be, like I said, just women are taking over this game.
So much so that the sport will be making its Olympic debut in 2028. The game slows down in the second half. Both teams struggle to break through one another's defensive lines while the game clock is running. 1 minute left. Things are heating up in the bleachers. 30 seconds left on the clock. The ref blows the final whistle.
the ball's in Loyola's quarterback's hands. Goes for it. The girls are screaming in celebration as they lift a huge blue banner with the words regional champions on it. Coach Padilla raises a large wooden plaque into the air for everyone in the bleachers to see. Afterwards, I ask running back Lily Sarli how she's feeling, her war paint now smeared and voice half gone.
I'm proud how we came back and we helped ourselves out. We stayed together as a team. We stayed motivated. We hyped each other up and we, like, helped push each other to be better.
The junior tells me playing the sport has helped her get closer to her dad.
I think that my dad and I talk a lot more, and, like, we both strategize, like, for, like, football games, like, what's coming up next, and he always helps me because he played running back when he was in high school, so that's how, like, we kind of, like, connect.
And the Savchenko WBEZ News.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for joining us. Be with us next week. We'll return with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Remember, you can find our episodes where you get your podcasts at nprillinois.org and through the NPR app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.